Yes, we're definitely thankful to be able to sit here and come together to study Scripture. And we just recognize, God, your promise that wherever two or three are gathered in your name, that you're there with them. So we're looking forward to hearing from you. Amen. Psalm chapter 19, psalm about God's revelation. Revelation just means to reveal something. So when theologians speak of God's revelation, primarily they're thinking in terms of God revealing truth to us. David was the author of this psalm. It was set to music. C.S. Lewis, a literary critic, professor, English professor from Oxford in the last century, wrote a book on the Psalms, and on page 63 he says, "I take this to be the greatest poem in the Psalter and one of the greatest lyrics in the world." Yes, better than Kanye West lyrics. This is in a league of its own. So let's read here. "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands." So the heavens and the skies. You see the intensification. Remember we talked about that in Hebrew literature. That the first aspect is the heavens, you know, the universe declare the glory of God, even down to the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Now, to declare and proclaim, according to commentator Derek Kidner, these are in the participial, which means that they keep on declaring. They keep on proclaiming. This is a continuous verb. So David is looking out. I don't know if you've ever done this. I'm assuming everyone here has, where you look out at nature and you're just so bamboozled. You're just looking around at it and you're like, whoa, man, this is beautiful. This is more beautiful than any artist's creation I've ever seen. Either the night sky or the day sky, the power of the sun, the moon. It's just so gorgeous. And David is saying something about this, this intuitive knowledge that we have through nature, something about this is communicating something about God as a craftsman. He says, day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. So he's communicating here, the skies, the created order, are continually revealing knowledge to us. They have no speech. Okay, he's being very clear. David's personifying the skies and the heavens is speaking. Not that they're speaking words. They use no words. No sound is heard. And yet, it's almost like when you go and ask out a chick that's not into you, and she just kind of tenses up and goes like this, you know. Now I'm busy walking my cousin that day, you know. You're like walking your dog. Yeah, whatever. You know, she can communicate something through body language without ever saying a thing. Well, David writes, their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the earth. And so he's saying here that something about creation reveals God's existence, certain parts of his attributes and his nature. And this is universal in scope. All the earth, whether you've ever picked up a Bible and heard about the Creator, you know, looking out at the universe, there's something here that reveals the very nature of God. And so we see David is arguing that every single person has an intuitive sense that the universe was, in fact, designed for humans. Now, you might think, well, yeah, David was writing 3,000 years ago, before the scientific revolution, before the Enlightenment, before we started to realize that there was actually natural causes behind all of this. And in a pre-scientific worldview, of course, you would come to the conclusion that, yeah, there's a ghost and a goblin under every rock and stone. And yeah, sure, there's a creator back then, but today we know better. Not true. Here's Richard Dawkins. Now, he's an atheistic biologist. He's one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. This is from his book, The Blind Watchmaker. This is the point he makes on page one. He says this: biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. You see, even Dawkins, an ardent atheist, does not believe in God, not even close. Even he, when he looks out into nature, he says, yeah, there's the appearance of it being designed. You can't get around that, of course. But he says, well, it was evolution. Evolution created it. Sure, there's the appearance. There's the intuitive notion that it was designed, but it's not actually designed. Michael Shermer, now this is the founder of the Skeptic Society. Okay, so he's not going to go soft on this issue. We can be sure. He says the design inference comes naturally. The reason people think that a designer created the world is because it looks designed. Yeah, of course. You look out at the universe, you look at the world, you look at life, and he's just flat out admitting, yeah, it does look designed. He says, I think we should quit tiptoeing around this inference and just admit that life looks designed because it was. Whoa. Yeah, it was designed. But then he concludes, from the bottom up, by evolution. So it wasn't a top-down design. It wasn't that there was a creator on the front end creating things. It's from the bottom up. You go from less complex to more complexity until you get this illusion of design. But make no mistake, they still acknowledge it does look designed. They've just offered a different mechanism, a different causal agency to explain it, which is neo-Darwinism. Now, here's our question for this evening, not neo-Darwinism, as interesting as that topic is. What if we look at areas of creation of the universe that actually lie outside the realm of Darwinism? What about areas that lie outside of this whole process? For example, the origin of the universe. No, you could not have Darwinism as a mechanism explaining how the universe came to be. And also the organization of the universe. We're not talking about on the microbiological level, but let's actually check. Let's look at the physical level of physics and cosmology. Well, let's look at our first point of contention, the origin of the universe. Now, there's two reasons why modern cosmologists and physicists today believe that the universe came into existence a finite time ago in the past, about 13.6 billion years ago. The first reason is the second law of thermodynamics, and the second is what's been called Big Bang cosmology. Now, up until the 20th century, people didn't always believe this. In fact, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, Aristotelian thought, Aristotle just believed the universe has always existed. Carl Sagan, up until the 1970s, he said the universe is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be. Yeah, secular or atheistic thinkers just believed in the Greek tradition that, you know, the universe has always been here, it always will be here. So when we look out at the universe, there's no explaining why it's there. In fact, Bertrand Russell was in a debate with a Christian philosopher back in 1948. This was on BBC radio, and the philosopher asked him, Dr. Russell, why do you think the universe is here? And he said, it's just there, and that's all. Just there. You can get the recording. He sounds just like that. I mean, he sounds way more intelligent than the other guy just because of his accent, but that's what people believe. It's just there. Up until the 20th century, I don't know if we realize how cool it is to be born in this exact time. Well, why do they believe that the universe came into existence? Well, the first reason is the second law of thermodynamics. This states that the amount of usable energy will decrease in a closed system. Now, this doesn't mean that energy goes away. Okay, that would break the first law. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. The second law says that energy will reach a state of higher entropy. That means the usable energy will decrease. So, for example, let's say I came in here and I brought a can of X body spray. And I just... Okay. And I smell like a frat guy on Saturday night. All right. I'm all hosed down. Now, eventually, the people in the front row would start to smell the Axe body spray. Yes? Well, according to entropy, according to the second law, that smell, those particles, will eventually reach the entire group. You would never expect to spray that in one part of the room and it would never reach another part, unless there just wasn't enough to spread out. Now, you might have pockets of usable energy. Yeah. But eventually, it will decrease in a closed system. Well, this is what's incredibly interesting about the second law. If we look at the universe as a whole, the universe itself is a closed system. Now, we're currently seeing pockets of heat and light in our universe, stars, supernova, planets, those sorts of things. They're on a half a tank of gas. These stars aren't going to burn forever. They're eventually going to burn out and entropy will take its place. Now, it might take 100 billion years. I get it. But eventually, given the second law, the stars are going to burn out. Well, here's the question. If the stars have been burning on a half a tank of gas and we know that they're not going to burn forever in the future, that must mean that they weren't burning forever in the past. If the universe is eternal, then this would mean that those stars would have burned out an infinite time ago. Now, it doesn't give us a date, but it definitely shows us that there's a finite amount of energy which must have been infused into our universe. And, of course, this was confirmed via the Friedmann-Lemaître model. These were two cosmologists, one of whom was Belgian, the other was Russian. They both came to this theory, which later was called the Big Bang. Now, how many people here have heard of the Big Bang Theory? Raise your hand. Okay, good. And all of us, we even went to public school and we still heard about it, okay? Big Bang cosmology, there's a reason you've heard of it. The reason is not because it's some kind of religious theory, okay? Big Bang cosmology is the dominant view in cosmological circles today. This is the view almost everyone holds. It's taught in textbooks. It's taught in schools. And what does the Big Bang actually state? Well, Stephen Hawking, this is back in 1996, he says this: almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. So this is coming from one of the most prestigious physicists and cosmologists in the working world today. He's just saying almost everyone believes that at this point. The universe had a beginning, a space-time beginning. John Barrow, agnostic physicist, this is from his book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. He says that this singularity, space and time, came into existence. Literally, nothing existed before the singularity. Nothing. And then there's the singularity and the universe came into being. So he writes, if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo or out of nothing. The singularity is to be regarded as being on the boundary of space-time. So that expression in Latin, ex nihilo, ex is the preposition from or out of. Nihil, like think of the Big Lebowski, we believe in nothing. The nihilists, the nihilists. Ex nihilo literally means out of nothing. Paul Davies, an agnostic physicist, this is from his 2007 book, The Cosmic Jackpot. He says, if we run the expansion in reverse for 13.7 billion years, then the ball, which if you have the context in the book, he's just saying the universe, the ball, the universe, shrinks to a single point, a single sizeless dot, and then nothing. The ball has vanished. Play the sequence forward and the universe appears from nothing at a single point, balloons out, and eventually expands to cosmic proportions. I know some people think that the Big Bang, well, all matter and energy were just condensed into like maybe like a basketball, you know, or maybe something the size of this room, and then it exploded from there. No. Given Einstein's theory of relativity, space and time are connected and they go to a point of infinite density. That means maximum mass and zero volume. In other words, nothing. It goes back to nothing. Davies says, now let's consider what is meant by nothing in the foregoing description. Clearly, it is empty space. If this account captures the essential manner in which the universe came into existence, then we are left with the puzzle. Why should a ball of matter suddenly appear out of nowhere at some particular moment in time and at some particular location in pre-existing empty space when this event hasn't happened for all eternity up until that moment? You go from nothing to everything. What caused that to happen? Well, he says, what would cause it to happen? It happened just then and just there. There is no satisfactory answer. He writes, the nothing before the Big Bang really is no thing, neither matter nor space, nothing. I've talked to people about this and they said, well, you know, you can get something from nothing. I'm like, OK, when you say nothing, what do you mean? They're like, well, like a quantum vacuum. I'm like, that's not nothing. That's something. That's a roaring sea of energy. OK, when he says nothing, how much clearer could he be? Space time comes down to infinite density. No thing. The absence of anything. Nothing. Then Davies says, could the singularity have not just sat there? In that case, what came before the Big Bang would no longer be nothing. It would be a singularity. Yeah, I've heard people say that too. Yeah, maybe it's just a singularity caused it. Yeah, a singularity. Let's just throw out a word. That caused it. Davies says, some popular accounts of the origin of the universe promulgate this dubious or doubtful notion. However, it won't do. The theory of relativity links space and time together to form a unified space-time. You can't have time without space or space without time. So if space cannot be continued back through the Big Bang singularity, then neither can time. This conclusion carries a momentous implication. If the universe was bounded by a past singularity, then the Big Bang was not just the origin of space, but the origin of time, too. To repeat, time itself began with the Big Bang. If there was no time or place before the Big Bang for a causative agency to exist, then we can attribute no physical cause to the Big Bang. You know, causative agency, that's philosopher speak for something to cause it. What could have caused this? Well, he's saying whatever caused it, it couldn't be physical. So, that just begs the question. Here we are. The universe popped into being. It couldn't have been something physical. So what was it? Could it be that it was a cause that was immaterial, non-physical, just as the Bible teaches, that it could be a spiritual being brought this into being from nothing? Now, the facts of the Big Bang are generally agreed upon. We did a reading there. I can promise you those quotes are not out of context. That's what they say. That's what they believe. It's not the facts. It's not the science that's really debated. It's the interpretation of the facts that's debated. And here's the question. Which worldview has the chutzpah to explain how the universe could pop into being from nothing? Here's Quentin Smith. He's an atheistic philosopher at Western Michigan University. This is in his book, Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology. This is what he writes on page 135. The most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. Okay, you're a philosopher. You have a PhD. It came from nothing. Yeah. By nothing. Yeah. And for nothing. Yeah. And that's the most reasonable belief. It just popped into being out of nothing. What about J.L. Mackey? This is from his book, The Miracle of Theism. He's a very well-renowned atheistic philosopher. He says there's no good reason why a sheer origination of things, not determined by anything, should be unacceptable, whereas the existence of a God with the power to create something out of nothing is acceptable. Okay, let's look at this. So, we have these two options. One is that nothing brought the universe into being from nothing. The other is that we have an infinite personal God brought the universe into being from nothing. So you're saying there's no good reason why one over the other? I mean, 100 years ago, atheists used to come after Christians and they'd say, oh, you believe that God brought the universe into being from nothing? That's ridiculous. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed. What did he create it from? We'd say, nothing. I mean, he's all powerful. He brought it into being. I don't know. He's God. He could bring it from nothing, you know. It's all that's ridiculous. He created from nothing. Now, in the present day, we've got atheistic philosophers saying one better. They're saying it didn't just come from nothing. It came by nothing. Who created it? No one. From what? From nothing. Okay, unless you're ruling out theism a priori, unless from the beginning you're saying, no, before we even look at the evidence, no possible way God could exist. You know, by saying this, by saying God couldn't have caused it, what you're really saying is that you're going to eliminate God as a possible cause by definition, not because of the evidence. Let me see if I can explain this differently, okay? You're a private eye, okay? You're a detective back in the 1950s in Mississippi. And you show up and there's a young white woman and she's been raped and beaten to death. So you start taking notes and you're smoking your cigarettes, you know, and you're doing what detectives do. I don't know. And, you know, you're going through and you're writing down and, okay, age 22 and white and writing your stuff down. And you stand up and you get all the information and your police commissioner comes up to you and he says, all right, McTaggart. That's your name, by the way, McTaggart. And all right, McTaggart, let's go find this son of a gun. Let's go nail him to the wall. All right, I'm going to put him on the electric chair. All right. You're like, okay. And just as you're about to leave, he says, now, wait a minute. Let's just find out that the criminal was black. What do you mean? Whoever did this, let's just find out he was a black guy. You're ruling out a priori who the guy was, not based on the forensic evidence. You're ruling him out based on the fact of a previous bias you already held. Now, the same thing is true when it comes to God. Some people will say, well, here's the scientific evidence. It could be theism or it could be naturalism. It could be one or the other. Some people say, well, God can't be an explanation. Why not? Because science only deals with natural causes. Who made that rule? So we're just saying from the beginning, it doesn't matter how much evidence is on the other side. If you assume going in, well, it can't be a creator, well, then it wouldn't matter how much evidence there was. Just like if you found fingerprints, footprints, eyewitness testimony that it was a white guy who raped that girl, you'd have to say, well, we can't pick a white guy because he's black. So let's look at another area we might look at, the organization of the universe. I don't know if you've kept up with this very much. In the last 30 to 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have discovered a number of natural laws, constants, and initial conditions for our universe that are, what they've come to find, are extremely fine-tuned to an infinitesimal degree. That if these laws were just off by like a little itty-bitty fraction, life couldn't possibly exist. What we find is that the laws, constants, and initial conditions are what they call life-promoting rather than life-prohibiting. They're just finely tuned enough. Here's Dawkins. Again, he's not going to go easy on us. This is from his book, The God Delusion. He says, physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. He writes, different physicists put it in different ways, but the conclusion is almost much the same. Here's Hawking from his new book, The Grand Design, 2010. The laws of nature form a system that is extremely fine-tuned, and very little in physical law can be altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life as we know it. Were it not for a series of startling coincidences in the precise details of physical law, it seems humans and similar life forms would never have come into being. Here's Martin Rees. He is an agnostic. And again, all these people I'm quoting, they're not Christians. They're not believers in God. Here's Martin Rees, cosmologist and physicist. This is from his book, Just Six Numbers. He picks just six of these. Okay, there's more. He just focuses on six. And he writes this, these six numbers constitute a recipe for a universe. Moreover, the outcome is sensitive to their values. If any one of them were to be untuned, there would be no stars and no life. We're talking about, okay, well, maybe evolution could have kicked in at this point. Dude, we're talking about no stars, no rocky planets. We wouldn't have carbon. Carbon. You need basic things like this for life. John Barrow writes this, another agnostic physicist. He says, at first, one might imagine that a change in the value of a constant would simply shift the size of everything a little, but that there would still be, you know, stars and atoms. You might think that. Well, maybe if the forces were a little bit bigger or smaller, well, maybe we would just be like 8 foot tall or 4 foot tall. He says this, turns out to be too naive of a view. It transpires that there exists a number of very unusual coincidences regarding the values of particular combinations of the constants of nature, which are necessary conditions for our own existence. Indeed, there is every reason to suspect that we wouldn't be here to discuss the matter. Yeah. Just to give you an idea, okay, what are we talking about? What spectrum are we thinking when we say the physical laws and constants are finely tuned? Here's Davies. He says, had the explosion of the Big Bang differed in strength at the outset by only one part in 10 to the 60th power, the universe we now perceive would not exist. Okay, 10 with 60 zeros after it. One part in 10 to the 60th. He writes, suppose you wanted to fire a bullet at a one-inch target on the other side of the observable universe, 20 billion light years away. Your aim would have to be accurate to that same part in 10 to the 60th. Okay? An infinitesimal degree, an infinitesimal chance. Now, this guy is a Christian. Here's Hugh Ross. I'm not quoting him for his science, though, just for his illustration. He says this, one part in 10 to the 37th. Now, that number was 10 to the 55th, 60th? I can't remember. What was it? That's what I said, 60th. He's saying 10 to the 37th power, that's not like half or two-thirds of 60, okay? 10 to the 38th is 10 times bigger than 10 to the 37th, right? Okay, we're on the same page. But let's just go with 10 to the 37th. We're lowballing it here. One part in 10 to the 37th is such an incredibly sensitive balance that it's hard to visualize. The following analogy might help. Cover the entire North American continent in dimes, all the way up to the moon, a height of about 239,000 miles, which would look like this. There you go. In comparison, the money to pay for the U.S. federal government debt would cover 1 square mile less than 2 feet deep with dimes. Okay, but we're going dimes all the way to the moon, the entire continental U.S., all dimes all the way. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. So dimes to the moon, then you have a billion other North Americas, same thing. He says, paint one dime red and mix it into the billions of other dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pick out the one dime. The odds that he will pick the red dime are 1 in 10 to the 37th power. Now, that's just one of the constants. That's one. And it's not even a good illustration for how big it is. Let's just think about this here. Okay, one of the constants that we see is the speed of the expansion of the Big Bang is 1 in 10 to the 55th. Let's lowball it, okay? Davy says 1 in 10 to the 60th. Let's just be conservative. Then we have the strength of gravity. That's one part in 10 to the 40th power. Now, it's not enough just to get one of these right. You got to have them lined up. As Barrow put it, a mysterious coincidence. They're coinciding mysteriously just right for life. Then you got the mass of the universe. That's 1 in 10 to the 59th power. Ratio of electrons to protons. That's 1 in 10 to the 37th. There's your dime illustration. Then you have the cosmological constant. This is by far the biggest. 1 in 10 to the 120th power. Guys, the amount of seconds the universe has been in existence is 1 in 10 to the 18th. Okay, or 10 to the 18th seconds. The number of protons and electrons and neutrons in the universe, 10 to the 80th power. This is 10 to the 100. And there's nothing you could point to in nature to come up with 10 to the 120th power. That's the point. And we're saying that there's up to 30 of these laws, constants, and initial conditions. And they all have to coincide perfectly. You see the name of that book? The Goldilocks Enigma. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Not too hard, not too soft, just right. Yeah, it's from Davies. He says there's up to 30 of these. Now, what we've been talking about here is evidence from the universe that, you know, I don't think it's overwhelming. I mean, I guess it's possible that there wasn't a creator. Yeah, it's a possibility, sure. But what I'm saying is that there's good evidence that if you believe in God, you don't have to blow your intellectual brains out to believe it. I mean, this is good evidence. And, you know, someone might say, you know, well, I just don't think that's good evidence. I don't think, you know, looking at science can ever bring me to belief in a creator. Well, if you don't think this is good evidence, then you have a problem. And the name of your problem is Antony Flew. Okay? Antony Flew was a British philosopher. He had written dozens of books on the philosophy of religion. One of the most ardent atheists of the 20th century, Antony Flew, just died a couple years ago. He debated ever. He sat underneath C.S. Lewis in Oxford, listened to Lewis's arguments for God and scoffed, said the guy is a fool. I can't believe anyone would believe in that. Debated William Lane Craig. Here is Antony Flew in a discussion with Gary Habermas, whom we're going to get this summer. He's coming to teach our class here at Xenos. And Flew and Habermas, they're both philosophers, both talking about the existence of God. There's his book in the upper left-hand corner from 1998, Atheistic Humanism. I mean, this guy was through and through, you know, hot-blooded atheistic thinker. Now, what was kind of interesting to discover was back in 2007, he wrote a book. And the name of the book was There Is a God. The subtitle was How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind by Antony Flew. The most hardcore. And okay, now you might ask, well, maybe he saw an angel or something. Or maybe like God spoke to him. Or maybe he like had a vision or had like a religious experience or a near-death experience. Not according to Flew. Okay, Flew says this. In his book, he says, I now believe that the universe was brought into existence by an infinite intelligence. I believe that this universe's intricate laws manifest what scientists have called the mind of God. You know, this material on fine-tuning the origin of life and Big Bang cosmology was presenting itself in the, you know, the 1980s and 90s. And Flew was reading this material and his faith in atheism weakened. In fact, he was buddies with Gary Habermas, who we're going to see this summer, And Gary Habermas would talk to him on the phone about his issues. And eventually he got to the point where he said, I just can't avoid it. I mean, it's staring me right in the face. How do you explain this? Flew said, it has had no connection with any of the revealed religions. Okay, it's not like, as some people say, well, you just believe in God because you want to go to heaven. Something like that. Flew didn't care about heaven or hell. Didn't have anything to do with the Bible. Didn't care. But he says, I don't even claim any personal experience of God or any experience that may be called supernatural or miraculous. Wasn't a vision. Wasn't an angel. Wasn't anything like that. He says, in short, my discovery of the divine has been a pilgrimage of reason, not of faith. Came to the point where the evidence was mounting and even. And, you know, I respect that. I respect that you could be, you know, so entrenched, so like your whole life. He was going to skeptic societies, writing books, giving lectures, giving debates. And then eventually the evidence was mounting until he reached a point where he saw, you know, I need to have intellectual integrity. I can't just give the same old aphorisms and mantras to keep people off my back. I mean, the evidence is right there. And what am I going to do with it? Yeah. And, you know, I think this just points back to the notion that what David was writing here is correct. You know, over the centuries, belief in God has been just derisively criticized. And yet in our own day, in the 20th and 21st century, we've seen evidence present itself. I guess the question is, okay, you can believe in a creator, but so what? You know, this didn't benefit Flew at all. It didn't help him at all. He came to believe in a creator, but that's about as far as he went. Well, David continues. He says, yet their voice goes out into all the earth. You can see intuitively, yeah, God, somebody created this. And he says, in the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. So the sun's coming through in the morning. And he says, it's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber like a champion rejoicing to run his course. So the imagery there is the guy right after his wedding night coming out of his place and being like, you know, he's just got the radiant. The sun is just so radiant. It's like that guy just like so happy. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. And so he's saying this is universal in scope. People can see this. Paul, probably thinking of this psalm, writes in Romans 1:19, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Yeah, God revealed this to us so we can know he's there. Now, creation can tell us something about the Creator, but it can't tell us everything about him. You know what I'm saying? Like, it can bring us so far, but unless he reveals more about himself, we're in the dark to some extent. Like, look at this painting here. You know, unless you're an art history major, you probably don't know who painted this. It's Monet, 1880, okay? Impressionism. So you're looking at this painting. But for the rest of us, okay, I didn't know until I hopped on Google Images, all right? And so you're looking at this painting and you're like, that's a beautiful painting. Who painted it? I don't know. What's the meaning of this painting? Not sure. Why did they paint it? You know, I don't know. Now, it does tell us something. I mean, if you look at a painting, you're like, I know my pet dog didn't paint that. I know someone painted it. Someone with intelligence and some kind of aesthetic that he could understand how to capture the sunset at Labacor is the name of the painting. And maybe he saw that, and it's probably a person, some kind of intelligent being, but you don't know enough about the person. You wouldn't know, like, how tall they were. You wouldn't know the color of their eyes. You wouldn't know if they were single. You wouldn't know their gender. You know, you wouldn't know too much other than the fact that they're just there. Well, this is where the psalm takes an interesting turn, because David goes on, right from the revelation of the universe, the world, into the revelation of the Word. And he switches gears and he says, the law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. And so he's saying, when you actually come into a relationship with this being, namely through the Word of God, you can actually come to know this being is trustworthy. This being is as perfect, as he says. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. This being is in the right. This being is good. He says, the fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm. All of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They're sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. So you go just from like an abstract creator to a being who is trustworthy, who is firm, even a being who rewards us. Yeah. He says, who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. And so he goes from a reflection on creation down into the Word of God. And you can see for David, just knowing that there's a God out there was not enough. He actually wanted to get to the point where he could depend on this being. You know, what use is it if God's out there? Okay, I guess he's there. But maybe he just wound up the universe and just let us go. Maybe he just doesn't care. Like a deistic perspective on God, maybe something like that. Doesn't answer prayer, doesn't care about us, doesn't love us. Not according to David. You know, if the first part's true, if the first part is true about David believing that, you know, there actually is a creator out there and he had insight into this 3,000 years ago, what about that second part? The notion that you could actually come to know God as a foundation for trust, security, and even redemption. You know, redemption just means that you're purchased. Like you might say, I went and redeemed my lottery ticket. I cashed it in. What the Bible teaches is that every single human being was redeemed. They are paid for. And the great and terrible cost of our redemption, as Peter puts it, was Jesus Christ's blood on the cross. He says that that blood was more precious than gold. More precious than anything you could put a price tag on. The Son of God died, paid for each one of us. And yet the Bible teaches, yeah, he died for us, but we need to actually come to know him personally. He's not going to force that on us. You know, I'm sure there's people sitting right here in this room that believe God exists. And yet maybe somebody brought you here tonight. Maybe you're doing some investigation into what you think about God. And maybe God has you here for a reason. And that reason is this, is to switch from believing that God exists to believing in God. Like, I have a 5-month-old son. I believe that there is a pedophile who lives on my street. I believe that he's there. But I don't believe in him to do free babysitting for me. You know what I mean? Like, I know that he's there, but I wouldn't, like, trust him. You know what I mean? You don't know what I mean? No, you know what I'm saying. Yeah, you know, it's different to just say, I know God exists. Yeah, but have you personally trusted him? And have you trusted in the gift that he's purchased for you? Yeah, there's a difference between just knowing he's there and trusting in him. Hey, if you're here with us, I want you to think about a passage. He says, behold, I stand at the door and I knock. And whosoever opens the door, I will come in and I will dine with him as friends. You know, if you just open the door of your heart to Christ, he will come in and you can know him. And then you could be like David. You could go from knowing God there to knowing God personally as your Redeemer. Wouldn't that be sweet? Hey, why don't you do that here with us tonight as we close up? Also, if you're a first-time guest, why don't you stop by the coffee bar next door? You can get a free book and a free drink we give out to people who are checking out our meeting. So, I left us some time. Why don't we open up with some maybe some questions, comments, or maybe some experiences you wanted to bring up, okay?
How you were talking early on about, you know, this that people can kind of think that David was from a more primitive time, but now we have, like, the scientific revolution and all that. And yet you, like, read the writings of guys like Isaac Newton, and, you know, he puts in the preface of his original, like, magnum opus of, like, physics, that he's writing this to show the glory of God, to prove that it isn't just some random chance, that it's got structure, that it's got meaning and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting how that has sort of deteriorated and it's gone backwards into this sort of magical sort of thinking of just it all just sort of happens. And
yeah.
Not only do we not know the explanation, but there's fundamentally can never be an explanation. And we're just going to accept that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's not quite honest to say we would look at every other thing in nature and we would say there has to be an explanation. And yet, when we look at the whole thing, we're going to say, that's a brute fact. We don't even ask questions about it. Who knows what we can't know? Okay, if there's a cause for everything out there, we should be able to see the cause for the whole picture. Why wouldn't we try and discern that? Okay, let's go up here.
I was just about to ask if you, I'm just a little curious because I feel like a lot of people do, like, have the information for it. But what do you think is, like, you know, either some misconceptions or reasons why people, you know, just don't want to take that into consideration, or if, like, they're scared of what that could be or whatever?
Well, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about belief in God, and I think a lot of this is just rhetoric. It's not actually the arguments, and it's not actually the thinkers. Those are not getting engaged with. It's mostly a lot of these mantras and things that are kicked around the internet and picking sides. I'm not into politics, but you see it in politics all the time. It's a mischaracterization of your opponent, and people are just satisfied just to leave it at that level. They're not actually willing to dig deeper and actually deal with the evidence. And I would just encourage people, you know, don't just stick with these little one-liners and quips you've heard. You actually look at what the evidence states. Okay, let's go down here.
Yeah, I can't remember if you quoted this passage or not, but kind of in relation to what Clarence was talking about. Paul says, and I think Romans 1, that people suppress the truth they know about God. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And that we're without excuse because we can see that God exists by looking into nature, by looking at what's been made.
Yeah.
So I think that's important to consider is that we have to remember that at the end of the day, people are not as convinced by the intellectual fronts they put up. But really, there is a bias. As much as we may want to call ourselves who are not spiritual free thinkers and whatnot, that's not the case. But there is a willful suppression. And I think going along with what you're saying about how we're finding new evidence in our lifetime, Paul's insight there in Romans 1 is spot on.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Bible is probably the most ridiculed book. I mean, if you compare it to any other spiritual book, the Bible has gone under incredible vitriolic criticism for centuries. And yet here we are 20 centuries after the New Testament was written, and we're still seeing these guys had it right from the beginning. That's strange. That this whole time they were right about the origin of the universe. They were right that there's something out there that looks like it needs to be beyond nature that could have brought this into being. And that should get us thinking, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay. So I don't know if you have ever taken a moment to think about hemoglobin, but I'm going to talk about hemoglobin.
Sweet.
So, and so when I read about this, and it's been a while, so don't quote me on it, but like I was just so astonished when I learned how it works. So, so there are four places that oxygen can bind to when you breathe in, and when you breathe in, you breathe in like oxygen, and when you exhale CO2. And so you breathe in and oxygen goes into your blood cells. And when CO2 leaves your body, where you've been using energy and like breaking down glucose, your muscles will like release that CO2. And releasing the CO2 makes oxygen leave the blood. And so basically your body was designed smart enough to know where oxygen goes and where your body needs it. And if it didn't have that exact calculation, like, you couldn't exist.
Hmm.
And I just think it's really interesting how many biological functions there are that, like, if there was one small thing different about it, nothing would be able to exist.
Yeah, there's other philosophers of science who actually think once you get into the realm of biology, not just physics and cosmology, but as you dig down deeper, that there's evidence for design on that level too. And that's something we didn't get into, which I wish we had time. You guys just want to stay for another hour? We'll do that. Okay, next time I'm coming at you with some hemoglobin, all right? All right, about back here.
I really liked your point about like the detective, because I feel like the general concept that's accepted is that the Big Bang Theory like disproves God, that he can exist in any way. And I guarantee if you went down to OSU and asked, you know, random students to be like, does the Big Bang disprove God? They'd all be like, yeah. And that's not true. And I really like that point. And I also like his point over there that there has to be that need there. I mean, there are people who could not care. You could give them all this evidence, but what's important there is that need.
Good point. All right, what over here?
I remember learning about this for the first time a couple of years ago as a senior in high school, and I thought, if I ever told this to anybody, they could never, ever just stare that in the face and say, well, God still doesn't exist. And so I just, like, whipped it out and told people about this, and I was like, they can't deny it, but they still did deny it. I was like, so I just kept on bringing more and more evidence and more and more evidence, and just kind of got into this argument with my friend about it, and kind of pushed him away and alienated from me. And I was like, what did I do wrong here? And I eventually learned, like, there's got to be some other reason he's going against God. It's not just evidence. It's not just intellectual debating with him. And with him, I found out later, like, there was some, you know, really bad past experience that he had with his family, where somebody who claimed himself to be a Christian, like, did something in their family that tore something apart in their family, where there's just like a huge family feud, a huge divide. And I thought, oh my God, like, now he's probably got a lot of hate towards it, and it's got nothing to do with intelligence. And I probably didn't help that at all.
Hmm.
And I was just being so, like, frustrated with myself and being like, I'm such a fool to think that just these arguments are going to convince people. I think that if someone's still denying this after hearing all these arguments, you have to wonder what else is under there.
Good point.
Maybe some experience. So careful when using this kind of stuff. It's not trump card.
Yeah, we got to make sure that we're not viewing people as robots where it's just information in produces result out. People are complex. They're emotional. They have histories. And we got to make sure we're hitting the entire person here. Okay, Nick.
So I thought your fine-tuning argument was pretty compelling. I liked your illustration. Obviously, there's still a lot of people that wouldn't agree with that. So I guess I had a two-part question. The first part would be, so what's like the leading argument against this, or how else would you interpret, from an atheistic standpoint, the fine-tuning of those constants? And the second part would be, one I've heard is, you know, there's just some other constant or law that we haven't discovered yet that kind of underlies all these and ties these all together. And we just haven't discovered that yet, but at some point we will.
I like the way you phrase that. How do they interpret the science? It's not that you have Christian science.
or creation science, and then you have atheistic, naturalistic science, we're agreeing on the data. That's in front of us. That's stable. The question is, how do you interpret it? And so what's interesting from an atheistic or naturalistic perspective, it's a philosophical answer. It's not a scientific answer. So the two I've heard the most are the anthropic principle and the multiverse, so-called. The first is the anthropic principle states that if the universe wasn't finely tuned just right, would you be here to be surprised about it? And it's a forceful argument because it's logically solid. Of course we would. If it's like saying, why am I never observing a square circle? I just don't see them anywhere. Well, it's of course it has logical force because you can't observe it if they aren't finely tuned. Then the other option is the multiverse, and this is the view that either there's other physical universes out there, and we just happen to hit the jackpot. Or there's other dimensions, and this is another view, that there's actually different dimensions out there of universes. Now, for the multiverse, here's Martin Rees, okay? He says this. Now, he's an ardent multiverse supporter, and he says that the multiverse theory is, quote, plainly still no more than a tentative hypothesis. He writes, these universes would never be directly observable, even in principle. Okay, so if they're outside of our purview, you can't see them if they're in a different dimension. So what's interesting is, backed into a metaphysical corner where you can't appeal to science, they have to make a leap of faith and say, well, it can't be God. There has to be an infinite number of unobservable universes out there. Here's George Ellis, okay, agnostic cosmologist. This guy is one of the most eminent dudes in the field. Okay, he says, even if the multiverse exists, it leaves the deep mysteries of nature unexplained. This is from Scientific American, 2011. He says, all the parallel universes lie outside our horizon and remain beyond our capacity to see, now or ever, no matter how technology evolves. We can't see them, nor will we ever see them. So it seems to get rid of one God, you have to invent an infinite number of universes to do it that aren't observable, can't be seen, even if technology increases, you can't. Now, for the anthropic principle, one of the illustrations I like to use is it true that if the universe wasn't finely tuned, we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it? Absolutely. That's absolutely true. But the question is, does it logically follow that we shouldn't therefore be surprised because we just happen to get the jackpot and be here? And so I give the illustration of a guy who's getting lined up being killed, okay? And he's got his hands tied behind his back and he's got a blindfold. And 100 armed marksmen go to shoot him. And they say, ready, men, aim, fire! He's standing there and he's, you know, pissing his pants. He's, and then they cut him loose and he hasn't been hit. He looks around at the wall. There's a silhouette of bullet shots on the wall. They send him back to his bunk that night. And he's just pacing the whole time, just thinking, you know, how could this be possible? They must have been all drunk. Well, no, even if they're all drunk, they would have hit me. Maybe their guns were filled with blanks and it was our comrade. No, because there was bullet holes in the wall. Maybe they just wanted to see me piss my pants, and so they did it on purpose. I don't know. And, you know, you're going back and forth, and then all of a sudden, the bunkmate speaks up, and he says, hey, buddy, if one of them hit you and you were killed, you wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. So go to sleep. Now, would that answer satisfy you? Would you be like, oh, good point. Yeah, I don't know my problem. I'll go back to sleep. So, okay, and then finally your final question. Then we got to close up. I'm having too much fun. We got to stop. But, okay, the final question is there a theory of everything? They call this the TOE, T-O-E, theory of everything. If there was some uniting theory that explains all of Newton's forces, the four fundamental forces, that would only push the question back a step as to why there's an overarching theory that explains all this. So even if you could harmonize all these forces, it still wouldn't explain it.